3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting Iran's foreign ministry Monday called new missile sanctions illegitimate. Iran drew condemnation from Western nations for two ballistic missile tests late last year, which were said to have violated UN Security Council resolutions. The U.S. enacted new sanctions Sunday against five Iranian nationals and a network of companies with links to the banned missile activity. An Iranian spokesman says his nation will respond to the U.S. sanctions by bolstering its legal ballistic missile program and promoting its defense capabilities. Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian says he had very limited human interaction and spent 49 days in solitary confinement during his 18 months in an Iranian prison. Rezaian is one of four Americans freed Saturday as part of a prisoner exchange with Iran. Moroccan officials say they have arrested a Belgian suspect linked to the terrorist attacks that killed 130 people in Paris last November. Morocco's Interior Ministry said the man was arrested Monday near Casablanca and had direct links with some of the Paris attackers. According to official data, fourth quarter growth in China's economy was 6.8%, the smallest increase since the global financial crisis began. Trade and consumer spending weakened in the quarter. The Chinese government is expected to increase spending and cut interest rates to bolster the economy. A band website says guitarist Glenn Frey of the rock group The Eagles has died. He was 67 years old. Iraqi police say three Americans missing in the country were kidnapped in an apartment in Baghdad. U.S. officials say they are working with Iraqi officials to find them. This is VOA News. People in the U.S. Monday observed a holiday marking the birthday of slain civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. The holiday was created in 1983 when then-President Ronald Reagan signed a bill designating the third Monday in January to honor King, who was born on January 15, 1929. British lawmakers debated Monday a petition signed by more than 500,000 people seeking to ban U.S. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump from Britain. Trump prompted outrage in Britain by calling for a temporary ban on all Muslims entering the United States. He proposed the ban after a mass shooting by two Muslims killed 14 people in California. Labor Party MP Paul Flynn thinks banning Trump is a bad idea.
The great danger by attacking this one man is that we can fix on him a halo of victimhood. We give him the role of martyrdom, which can seem to be an advantage among those that support him.
In the past, people have been banned from entering Britain for fostering hatred that might provoke inter-community violence. U.S. Ambassador to Israel Daniel Shapiro accused Israel Monday of having separate standards of justice for Jews and Palestinians. Shapiro spoke at a security conference in Tel Aviv.
Hovering over all these questions is the larger one about Israel's political strategy vis-a-vis its conflict with the Palestinians. What is Israel's plan for resolving the conflict, for remaining a Jewish and democratic state? And if it judges a political solution to be out of reach for the time being, then what is its plan for managing and stabilizing the conflict?
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called Shapiro's comments untrue and unacceptable. Speaking in the Nigerian capital, Abuja, Information Minister Lai Mohammed launched an anti-corruption campaign by telling reporters billions of dollars have been stolen from the government. The thefts occurred between 2006 and 2013. He accused 55 people, among them former governors, cabinet ministers, and government workers, with the crime. He did not identify the accused, but said bankers and businessmen are also among them. Saudi-led airstrikes killed at least 26 people in the Yemeni capital overnight. The attack on police headquarters also wounded dozens. Diplomats at the United Nations say next week's scheduled peace talks on Syria may be delayed because world leaders disagree about which Syrian opposition members should be invited. The talks are set to open January 25th in Geneva. A Russian parliament committee has rejected a bill that would have levied fines or exacted jail terms for those found guilty of non-heterosexual public displays of affection. The law had been proposed by Communist Party members in the legislature. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, January 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda's only female candidate in February's presidential election discusses why she should be elected.
Basically, I would let the people of Uganda to elect me because I want to redo the foundation of Uganda. The issues in Uganda start way back in 1900 at its foundation.
Maureen Chalia is the only female candidate in Uganda's upcoming February presidential election. We'll tell you why Guinea-Bissau's parliament descended into chaos on Monday. Cameroon says Boko Haram is targeting cattle and food. And the DRC Congo government wants to prosecute rebel leader Jeremy Katanga after his ICC jail term.
Long ago, when their colleagues of the International Court started to sue Katanga, they were too fine that they were not taken into account.
Lambo Mende is the information minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. South Sudan's government, a yet-to-be-formed national unity government, is urged to reduce income inequality. And it was a day of service yesterday as Americans commemorated Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy. Those stories, plus Marco Woman Sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The only female candidate in Uganda's upcoming February presidential election says she is running because she wants to rebuild the foundation of the nation away from its colonial connection. Maureen Chalia, a former advisor to incumbent President Yoweri Museveni on poverty alleviation, also said she wants to unite the people. But she said she does not believe the election will be free and fair because President Museveni has created laws that make it harder for his challengers to have access to the voters.
Basically, I would let the people of Uganda to elect me because I want to redo the foundation of Uganda. The issues in Uganda start way back in 1900 at its foundation. Uganda is basically made up of different people with different characteristics, about 15 kingdoms they were, and different languages. But when it was being formed, the British only signed a contract with one of the kingdoms, and everybody was literally forced to become part of Uganda. We have fought since then. We've killed each other since then, but we have never sat on a round table to discuss it and even agree on the kind of governance that we should have. To date, even the current president was never elected into power. He came by gun power and has made sure he rigs elections every single time. So I decided to take part in the elections to appeal to Ugandans that we need to get on a round table.
As you mentioned that Uganda has never had a peaceful transition, so what do you think are the chances that the list of candidates can defeat President Museveni? And do you think the elections can be free and fair?
In a few words, the election has been rigged already because first and foremost, the Ugandan law says that all public servants have to resign before taking part in the elections, have to resign their offices. The incumbent did not resign. He is the president of the country. At the same time, he's the aspiring candidate. And during this time, he is making all sorts of oppressive laws to make sure that he actually has no access to the public.
Do you think the people of Uganda should vote for you because you are a female candidate?
Yes, they will vote for me because I'm the only female candidate, actually. And I am also the only candidate from my side of the region, which has even a bigger population than the whole country. But what the incumbent president has done, he has commercialized politics to the extent that even a five-year-old child in Uganda knows that for somebody to be voted, they must give you money. Now, unless you are in the government like he is and you are using the government treasury to give out money, an individual cannot have enough money to give to each and every single voter in the country.
There was a debate last week of the presidential candidates and the incumbent, President Museveni, stayed out of the debate. In fact, he said that debates are for school children. What do you make of that?
I really think, one, he's definitely too arrogant, and also he has taken on so much power. He's more like Saddam Hussein or Gaddafi, if I can put it that way. I believe power has gone to his head. He believes he's a god now. And the people, the Ugandans, are watching him as well, because right now, to get any job in Uganda, you must be attached to the NRM government.
Marie Chalia is the only female candidate in Uganda's upcoming February presidential election. She was speaking with me from Moya District in northern Uganda. The Democratic Republic of Congo said it will prosecute notorious militia leader Jeremy Katanga after he completes his sentence handed down by the International Criminal Court. Katanga, 37, was sentenced to 12 years in prison by the International Criminal Court in The Hague for complicity in crimes against humanity and war crimes over the 2003 attack on the village of Bogoro, including murder and pillage. He had been scheduled to leave prison in Kinshasa yesterday, Monday. The DRC's Information Minister Lambert Mende says that the judicial system, not the Congolese government, will put Katanga on trial because he was implicated in other cases just as serious as the one for which he was convicted by the ICC.
Justice is prosecuting Katanga. There is a difference between the justice and the government. It is exactly like in the United States. Why are you thinking that in Africa, government is equal to the justice? We are the government. That is a decision from the judiciary. So you are speaking of the government prosecuting Katanga. The government is not prosecuting anyone. We have no right of prosecuting people. It is a decision taken by the judiciary of Congo. Long ago, when their colleagues of the International Court started to sue Katanga, they were too fine that were not taken into account. And our general prosecutor said then, by then, that when we will finish with the international court, they will open the file of these incriminations. It is not a decision by the government.
The justice minister is with your government. So isn't this going to be a double jeopardy if he already served time for the international?
You better report to someone who studied law. You speak of double incrimination when he was done for these incriminations. Supposing that you are being judged for having stolen something, and you have stolen something, and you have raped a woman, and they judge you just for having stolen. And when you come out, they sue you for having raped. Nobody can say that it is a double incrimination. He was not judged for these fines they are opening now in Congo. They were a decision taken by our judges that if the international court did not open the fine about which they are going to judge him now, the Congolese justice will open those fines because he was not judged for that behavior. So it is not a double incrimination. It is not a right way of thinking.
The concern is, let's say he goes on trial in Kinshasa or wherever, would it be fair?
It is not because something is being done in Kinshasa that it is not fair. We are usually people from some Western countries thinking that whatever being done in our country is not fair because we are what? Because we are black people or what? Stupidity. We know the law. We know what is written in our constitution. Katanga has rights. He will be accompanied by lawyers, and he will defend himself, and it will be fair that he was not judged for these incriminations. He is going to be judged for them with the international court. So it will be fair. He might be sent free, he might be condemned, depending on what the judge will decide.
Lambert Mende is Information Minister for the Democratic Republic of Congo. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. Today is Tuesday, January 19th, and you are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 14 and a half minutes past the hour. Guinea-Bissau's parliamentary session descended into chaos yesterday, Monday, after leadership from the ruling PAIGC party kicked out members from their party who had previously failed to vote in favor of the government's program. The opposing party members sided with the expelled PAIGC representative. Vincent Foucher, a West Africa senior analyst for the International Crisis Group, tells Ricky Schreier this means Guinea-Bissau is virtually operating with two national assemblies.
All the MPs turned up, including the ones that had been fired and excluded from the PHSC and that supposedly lost their mandate, and the one under deputies that the PHSC put in their stead. And so everybody basically came to the assembly, and so it became very difficult to work it out. Who was going to do what? And the opposition party, the PRS, was basically siding with those MPs that had been excluded, and the PRS with the excluded MPs, they have a majority over the loyalist PHSC. So it all became a mess. The session was suspended, and the loyalist PHSC MPs basically left with the government, with the cabinet and everybody. And in the assembly stayed only the PRS, the leading opposition party, and the dissident PHSC MPs. But those dissidents and the PRS together, as I say, they are a majority. They are you know, more than a 50% majority in parliament. The vote was supposed to happen today, and so it didn't take place. But what took place, the dissidents, like the PRS, basically voted to designate a new president of the parliament, a new speaker. Now we have two speakers. Basically, now we have two assemblies and two speakers. And so now, so I'm hearing this sort of shuffles with diplomats trying to work something out. But, you know, it's quite a mess, really.
The government's budget still has not been voted on.
No, neither the program nor the budget. I suspect that each assembly will, because if you go to the loyalist PHSC assembly, now there are almost only loyalist PHSC MPs. There are a few independent MPs as well. But, like, so they're going to vote 100% for the program. And if you go to the other assembly, they're going to reject it. So we're going to have two votes. Oh, maybe, I'm not sure, but you know, basically there are two assemblies, two speakers.
What does this mean for, you know, the everyday Bissau Guinean right now?
It started in the summer, and basically since the summer, a lot of the assistance programs have been on hold or slowed down or suspended. So some things have resumed since October, since we have this new prime minister. But, you know, basically donors are extremely worried, you know. I mean, who is ruling in the country?
What about the 1 billion euros that was pledged almost a year ago now to support this 10-year development plan?
There were programs that had been engaged from before, and there were new programs. I mean, it was really a mixed bag, this money. Some of the money has come already, but, you know, a substantial part of the money is still on hold.
What's the road to resolving this?
You should check the news and, like, the kind of accusations that are being floated in the blogs or by sort of junior members on both sides. Yeah, very serious accusations. I mean, it really is not a good mood these days. You know, at this stage, I think the only thing that works is international mediation.
That was Vincent Foucher, a West Africa senior analyst for the International Crisis Group. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Maiduguri, Nigeria. Boko Haram militants not only have taken the lives of more than 1,000 civilians and soldiers in Cameroon, but the government says the country has lost thousands of cattle, sheep, and goats to the terrorist raiders. As Moki Edwin Kizeka reports from Yaoundé, this is a blow to farmers in the country's border areas who are struggling.
Cattle rancher Musa Ibrahima has settled with his family and 45 cows along the banks of the River Vina in Goundary in the Adamawa region of Cameroon. The 55-year-old rancher says he left his hometown about 650 kilometers away because of Boko Haram attacks.
No. You think say I feel go for Fotokol again?
He says he will not return to his town of Fotokol on Cameroon's border with Nigeria because Boko Haram fighters have been attacking and killing cattle ranchers. He says many of the ranchers who were forced by Boko Haram fighters to take their cattle to Nigeria have never returned. Kalbasu Daniel, a lawmaker from northern Cameroon, says at times the attackers disguise themselves as cattle ranchers transporting their cows to Nigerian markets. He says the Boko Haram fighters have been increasingly stealing food and cattle from Cameroonian ranchers and farmers.
Ils ont tué tous les bergers qui étaient partis avec les bœufs là-bas.
He says just last week, Boko Haram militants killed 15 ranchers and their cattle escaped to the hills near Nigeria. He says no one has been able to go and bring back the cows because of fear and it is lots of money lost besides the hundreds of ranchers killed. Boko Haram extended its attacks from Nigeria to Cameroon 3 years ago after Cameroonian troops began assisting the Nigerian military in fighting the extremists. Cameroon government spokesman Issa Chiruma Bakari says about 1,200 soldiers and civilians have died since then. He says at least 5,000 cows have also been stolen and uncountable numbers killed.
In 2014, 1,160 cattle were stolen from our people by the Boko Haram criminal and barbaric hordes. In 2015, the number of cattle stolen on the Cameroonian territory was around 4,200, excluding small ruminants.
Chiruma says although the fighters have in recent months targeted farmers and cattle ranchers, the rebels' ability to strike has been drastically reduced by counter-offensives on their strongholds by Cameroonian and Nigerian troops. Moki Edwin Kinzaka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
A Juba-based think tank says the yet-to-be-formed transitional government of national unity must reduce income inequality in South Sudan. In a paper released over the weekend entitled Inequality and Economic Outcomes in Sub-Saharan Africa, the head of the Ebony Center for Strategic Studies says South Sudan should build an inclusive economy that benefits all. Mugumi Davis-Rakariji has more for VOA from Juba.
A recent report by the International Monetary Fund says income inequality in sub-Saharan Africa is one of the highest in the world. Ebony Center Managing Director Rual Achui Deng says income inequality negatively affects growth. And in a country like South Sudan, where money is controlled by a few elites, Deng says the capacity to buy goods and services is limited, which suppresses economic growth.
Economy need more people to consume things so that producers can respond, produce more and consume more. But if the income is in the hands of few, they can't consume much. And then the money, they either put it away in the country, in the banks or in assets and other things, or take it out of the country.
Deng says South Sudan's extreme high rate of illiteracy is one of the primary causes of income inequality, since most people don't have the skills to get a job. A 2009 Sudan Household Survey conducted before South Sudan's independence reported that more than 70% of the population was unable to read or write. Deng says income inequality among South Sudanese women is particularly high, due in large part to cultural practices that deprive women of property and land rights, as well as equal access to education. At a public discourse on the Ebony Center report on Saturday, Sarah Yakub said most women in rural areas cannot afford to pay for even basic services.
If they don't know how to market their things, is the government not having a big role to sensitize women, to give them orientation, tell them how to add value to their products that they have so that the products they have market, tell them how to bring their products from where they are to the market?
Yakub, who works for Central Equatoria Women Union, says rural residents have far less income than those living in urban centers because they cannot access markets for their produce. Youth activist Asentewa Eriani says the upcoming transitional government should create employment opportunities for the country's youth so they can earn a living.
People look at young people as troublemakers. They're here on the street all over. There's a bunch of boys who sleep on the street. They're increasing every day. People, one day somebody was talking about how this is dangerous. Nobody's asking, why are they on the street? What are we doing to keep them out of the street? That means there's a problem in the home. There's a problem in our society. But nobody is focusing, and I think it's a ticking time bomb.
More than 70% of South Sudan's population is under the age of 35, according to the National Bureau of Statistics. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rakarinji in Juba.
On the third Monday of January every year, Americans observe the memory of slain civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. Many around the country spend the holiday commemorating King's tireless work to end racism and promote civil rights by participating in community service projects. This includes the First Family. Alberto Pimienta reports.
President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama got their hands dirty during the MLK holiday.
Spinach is outstanding, man.
The Obamas gave back by planting vegetables at a Washington, D.C. elementary school. The president and the First Lady also packed bags of school supplies for students in need, many of them from military families. In 1994, Congress designated the holiday as a national day of service. So on Monday, many Americans were out helping their communities.
We'll have about 500 volunteers mobilized today for the MLK Day of Service.
In Texas, people helped clean the streets of Austin.
We have about 300 people that are doing a litter cleanup along MLK Boulevard. So it's many miles, and they're splitting up into groups of 50 to make sure that all of the stretch gets cleaned up.
Organizers say this honors Dr. King's legacy of service.
450 people from all over the city, all communities in the city, all walks of life, all ethnicities, all races, all genders, all everything combined together to make the community a little bit better.
Many here say this is not a day off, but a day on to help each other. Alberto Pimienta for VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. A flood of second-half goals saw Nigeria triumph convincingly against Niger 4-1 at the Orange African Nations Championships at the Nyamirambo Stadium in Kigali, Rwanda on Monday. Moses Okoro found the back of the net shortly after the interval. Then second-half substitute Chisom Chikatara scored a hat-trick for Nigeria before Adje Zakari Adebayo converted Niger's consolation goal. Earlier on at the same venue, Guinea twice came from behind with goals from Alseni Kamara to hold Tunisia to a 2-2 draw in the other group C tie. Ahmed Akaisi scored both goals for Tunisia. Today, Tuesday, the spotlight is at the Umuganda Stadium in Gishenyi at the tourist resort on the shores of the Lake Kivu, 160 kilometers northwest of the capital Kigali. Zimbabwe engage Zambia, then Mali play Uganda in Group D action. Meanwhile, Frenchman Hubert Velud is the new coach of the Orange Africa Champions League title holders TP Mazembe, the club disclosed at their headquarters in Lubumbashi in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He replaces compatriot Patrice Calderon. Turning to athletics, Stephen Mozia set a Nigerian national record of 21.03 meters in shot put at the Commodore Invitational Indoor Meeting in Nashville, Tennessee State in the United States of America on Saturday. Besides improving on his outdoor Nigeria record of 20.46 meters, Mozia now leads the world ranking in the event this year. Finally, in boxing, Ugandan Farouk Daku is the new World Boxing Forum super middleweight title holder. Daku beat Hungarian Joseph Kormani by a 12-round unanimous decision to secure the title in Kampala, Uganda on Sunday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A Kenyan army unit reportedly decimated in an attack by Al-Shabaab militants last Friday had received warning of the assault, according to a Somali general. That's it for this Tuesday, January 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Marco Uman, along with our engineer Charles Hall. I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. Peace talks between the Burundian government and the opposition groups have been postponed, with no word on when they may resume. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss the crisis in Burundi. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Tuesday on Health Chat. Host Lenore Modou will discuss the health aspects of refugees and internally displaced people with Mark Yurnell, Senior Advocate Refugee International. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voa.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back.